when presented with a challenge, it's not ever it doesn't set me in depression. It sets me into motion. And it just is, instead of going straight, I think I now have to turn left. And I think I probably have to go very, very far away from what my objective is. And I know to get there, I have to go this way. And it's going to look really weird to people on the outside. And I'm going to meander for a long time. But I promise that is the objective over there. This happens to be the path to get there.
Oh, hi, everyone. I'm very excited for today's episode. We have here Dr. Cori Painter. She's the Deputy Director of the Count Me In Initiative at the Broad Institute of MIT at Harvard. She's the President of Angiosarcoma Awareness and Nonprofit. And she holds she's a scientist, so she holds a PhD and a postdoc from UMass Medical School. I first contacted Cori because of a very, very touching and personal post I found on LinkedIn. And that's the privilege I have as a podcast host, just to contact any person that I find interesting. And I'm really happy that I did, not just because her story is really interesting and touching and has everything about it that you want to hear in a story, but also because it demonstrates the power us as scientists have on this society. We usually are not aware of it. We're very focused on our work. We're interested in a specific protein or process or even a disease, but we don't really appreciate the amount of appreciation or the amount of power we have in order to really move the world if we choose to. So hi, Cori. I'm very happy to have you here.
Hi. Thank you so much for inviting me here today.
And hi, Ofer. I'm really happy that you can join this episode as well.
Hi. I'm very excited. The preliminary talk we had was amazing. And it filled me up for days and days and weeks after. So I'm really happy that we have the ability to share this, your point of view and journey. It's going to be awesome.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, Cori, can you introduce yourself a little bit?
Yeah. So I am, as you said, Cori Painter, and I'm at the Broad Institute. I've been here for about 7.5 years, and I came to really fundamentally change the way that we engage with cancer patients as we try to generate and share genomics data on their behalf in order to fuel discoveries.
Wow. So how did you reach it? So we said you have a UMass Medical from a PhD. So what were you studying during your PhD?
When I was at UMass, I was a protein biochemist, and I was in an immunology lab, and I was 100% obsessed with every possible iteration of rotamers of one particular protein in the immune system called MHC class II. I couldn't sleep at night because I'd be thinking of whether or not this phenylalanine was located in one direction or the other, because that had implications for peptide binding, and that would keep me up at night. So it was just like the puzzle and the mystery of what was going on at the atomic level to move those proteins that we only see as these static pictures in all of our textbooks that drove me as a scientist and drove my intellectual curiosity. And that was definitely what I was going to do for the rest of my life. And it looks something like this. You fall in love with science, you become a scientist, and then you become a professor and you have a lab. And that's what I thought the world of science was. Like, that was it. And it didn't even really occur to me that there were other avenues, there were other directions. I kind of heard whispers that there was this thing called industry and that there was these other jobs in pharma. I knew they existed, but they were so far out of my mental makeup of what a scientist did, it never occurred to me to do anything other than an academic tenure track sprint to get my own lab.
Very classical.
We never heard that. That's very, it's very new.
I was alone in the world in that thought process.
I wonder who encouraged that one.
Yeah. So there I was, you know, plugging away, solving, looking at my electron density maps, and all was going well. I had two kids. They were so cute. They were 2 and 4 years old, little girls. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, I found a lump in my breast. And I didn't know what it was, but I knew enough. Like everything in my life, that's tragic. It happened on a Friday afternoon when I had no access to anybody who knew more than Dr. Google. And so I turned to the internet and I started like madly looking at what this possibly could be. And I knew enough to be able to filter down to the things to give me an indication as to whether or not it felt like what a breast tumor should feel like. And it didn't feel like that. It like moved freely in the tissue and it was like kind of like flaccid. It wasn't like this nodule. And so I had convinced myself by the time Monday morning rolled around that I was totally fine.
Good,
right?
Good
I'm
job.
Fine. Like Google told me I am fine. But I made an appointment with my OBGYN regardless. And if I just cut to the chase, literally, it took, it wasn't fine at all, though it took several diagnoses and misdiagnoses. It took 11 core needle biopsies, a fine needle aspiration, every imaging modality, and a full surgery before I got a definitive diagnosis of this exceedingly rare cancer called angiosarcoma that only gets about 300 people a year. This is a blood vessel tumor. Yeah, it's so rare. It's ridiculous. It's a blood vessel tumor. It starts in the endothelial cells, which are the inner lining of your blood vessels. And because they're blood vessel born, they can really pop up anywhere in your body. I was extraordinarily lucky that mine popped up in my breast because I could feel it. And because I could feel it, I was able to detect it at an earlier stage than most people who have this devastating disease that only presents in the metastatic setting. And so, you know, after I had that surgery, it was supposed to be a lumpectomy. I woke up from surgery. My extraordinarily skilled surgeon told me that he had never seen anything that looked like that was not malignant. So he, on the fly, gave me a partial mastectomy. And though he was able to achieve clean margins, they went back 2 weeks later and took everything down to the bone because the natures of sarcomas are that they are not well circumscribed. They don't grow in like a ball. They grow these long tendrils that sometimes have like one cell thickness as they just reach through your tissue. And they could not guarantee that they had clean margins. So it was extraordinarily devastating. My kids were so young. My little one was too young to explain what was going on. My older child was able to ask things like, where did my breast go? And what were those things which were drains? What were those things that were sticking out of my body? And it was
what
really
was
difficult.
The actual prognosis?
It was very grim. Like there were these little blood clusters, like these atypical vascular malformations kind of throughout my body and my liver and in my lungs. And they didn't know if those were in my uterus. They didn't know if those were, if it was metastatic disease or if it was cancer. And they were kind of like small and diffuse. They didn't want to biopsy them. So the prognosis was maybe like a month or two, or who can say? And so they didn't know. They were just like, we just have to watch and wait to see if they grow. And it's been 12 years. And we're still watching and waiting. I've known people who were fine this long who also had these things from the beginning that looked to be nothing. And then they took off overnight and those people succumbed to the disease within weeks. And so you're never out of the woods with this
thing. So
there
was no treatment around those 12 years, just the first surgery? Yeah,
they, you know, my doctors didn't, I became acutely aware of what happens in a data vacuum when you're a patient. There's just nobody knows what to do with you. They don't even really have solid anecdotal evidence because there's so few of us that they try something once and then they never really see another person that was similar, right? And so the doctor did his best and he just like drew a bunch of different regimens in pencil. I still have this piece of paper and handed this to me and said, if you want to like say you tried, just pick one of these. Literally his words. And I was like,
oh my gosh.
All right. You know, and so I did. I picked a Taxol gemcitabine combination and I stayed on it long enough to lose all of my hair and get some side effects. But once you have the cancer taken out and there's nothing to monitor and there's no data to suggest that you're doing anything, How long do you stay on that regimen? Mm-hmm. You know, there's like no data to guide what you should do. And then there's even less data to guide how long you should do that thing you don't know if you should be doing in the first place. And so I was like, yes, I'll stop, you know? And so I stopped. And then I've just been waiting and watching ever since. What started off as 3-month interval, full body scans turned into 6 months, turned into a year. And now I've kind of let them trail off until I have some weird thing going on and I freak out and get a scan. That's kind of how I live my life today.
Sounds reasonable. Yeah. So you were right. You were towards the end of your PhD when you found this out, right?
Yes, I was actually supposed to defend my thesis right around that time. In fact, there was an empty chair at commencement with my name on it as I was recovering from that second surgery. And so I have to just give a shout out to my graduate school PI, Larry Stern, who's still at UMass, who was just an extraordinary mentor and just a solid, solid person. And he just made it crystal clear that I could stay a grad student with him forever, you know, and I think we both mm-hmm. knew what that meant. Mm-hmm. And I did, I pushed back graduation for a full year. And when I didn't die, I was like, maybe I should do something with whatever this time is that I actually have. Mm-hmm. And I went ahead and defended my thesis, and I still stayed in his lab for another year and did a modified postdoc. And right. It was during that time where I did a lot of really deep soul searching as to what I could actually do in whatever time I had to make an impact. And it was also during that time where I really started to think outside of the box. When your career ambitions are stripped away because your mortality is suddenly thrust upon you mm-hmm. and you don't care, you don't care what you're going to do, and you're only trying to make impact, it reframes your incentives in a way that opens up possibilities you didn't know were even feasible or possible.
So, okay, it opens up possibilities and really it puts you against the wall, and you have to make something else. But how you go along and like finding out what is, usually we ask at this point, what is interesting to you? But I guess now the question is like, what is the impact you wanted to do at that point and how we drove your search?
Yeah, it's a great question. I basically got a shotgun in my hand so that I could have a wide field. And so I cast a wide net. And so I was thinking, I'm probably not going to live very long. What if I only have like 6 months to a year from this point on, what could I realistically accomplish? And I thought, okay, I could start a foundation and pass the torch to somebody else to like continue to like raise money and do some science. I could directly try to do some science myself. You know, I could either do that in the lab I'm in, or I could try to find a postdoc that would enable me to do some like science that I think would actually come to bear on this disease. I could do all kinds of outreach and bring awareness to this disease. And so I ended up doing all of those things. And I started a foundation. It's still in existence, called the Angiosarcoma Awareness Inc. And we raise money. I don't ever put out an RFA. I do, because I'm a scientist. I know that I can do more impactful work stitching together people where I know them, and at least through the literature and what their interests are. So I'll find people that don't know that they could do great work together, and use little bins of money to encourage these collaborations. Oh, and wow. So maybe like a vascular biologist with like a sarcoma mouse model person, and like maybe those, you know what I mean? Like maybe they can make a PDX, you know, so things like of that nature. And so I'll bring them together. And, or if there is somebody with a good solid idea and backing an angiosarcoma, encourage them to write a grant that I think would be beneficial to the field. And then I have baked into that granting mechanism the need to open source whatever it is they do. So if they've generated data, it has to go in the public domain. If they've generated a reagent, it has to go into either like ATCC or, you know, something where somebody else can benefit. It's never intended to go into just like a publication for somebody's career advancement. And so that was kind of the philosophy through which I generate and give away money. It's really intended to drive this field as much as you can when you're up against something so rare and you're a pragmatist. I know I'm never going to like cure a disease by having, you know, like a figure in a paper. I get that. But maybe I can add to a groundswell of things in the space of rare cancers or in the space of sarcomas, you know, more broadly, that can, you know, leverage the power in numbers necessary to really have forward momentum in a meaningful way. Yeah. So I did that, started that. And then I was writing for grants to do cancer immunology. I was like obsessed with cancer immunology. This was before the big seminal Jim Allison paper on CTLA-4. I had gotten my hands on the original notes from William Coley back from the late 1800s. He was a sarcoma surgeon at Memorial Sloan Kettering. And he made this observation that some of his sarcoma patients would have their tumors spontaneously regress after having a high fever. He then took the virulent bacteria, you know, inactivated them, but took the cell walls and started in, like making these like elixirs and like injecting them right into the tumors or like giving them systemically to his patients to induce these high fevers. And then he wrote copious notes about the outcomes. And he did this to 5 angiosarcoma patients who were metastatic. And 4 of them went into these complete and durable remissions. And he went on to talk about their children and their grandchildren and how one died because they fell down the stairs when they were old. And he just like outlined lives of these people. And I thought, oh my God, that's it. That's what I need to do. Cancer immunology. So I ended up still staying alive another year. And I landed this really wonderful opportunity to do a postdoc developing zebrafish melanoma models for live cell imaging of the tumor immune compartment. It was really, really cool. It was very innovative. The grant came through the Cancer Research Institute, which is a, you know, just a phenomenal granting funding mechanism. Mm-hmm. And I was extraordinarily lucky to land that grant. And it was so interesting going from protein biochemistry into like cancer in a fish model. It was like hugely radical. And like all of the twists and turns my career has taken, that was the hardest for my brain to wrap itself around. Because like, I'm like used to like making sure I have like very tight numbers, very, you know, like there's absolutely not a shadow and a doubt that an atom is in this space. And now I'm like looking at a tumor under a microscope and is that green thing actually even a cell? And if so, is it like crawling through a tumor, you know? And so it was like a very radically different form of science, but it went really, really well. And I ended up generating a ton of data and I was able to parlay all the work that I did there into securing what's called a K99 grant, mm-hmm. which is a pathway to independence grant. And this like stark, again, back to impact, this stark moment happened in that application process. First, I was thinking that my life goal and career at that point was I'm going to set up shop as a melanoma research scientist, and I'm going to have to be super successful and really well funded. And I can sneak an angiosarcoma project in, and that's going to be my contribution. I'm going to do it. And wow. I can have my advocacy group on the side and I can fund other people. And so like that was
going to say, it's unbelievable. You're doing that with 2 kids and a sort of a terminal prognosis.
It wasn't easy.
It wasn't easy.
Like, it was
finishing a PhD is not easy.
It's funny, and I'll talk about this at some point in the podcast, but to cope with all of this, I developed these super intense grounding hobbies that are kind of like the cornerstone of my life now. Mm. And that'll be a little preview. I'll talk about that later. Mm. But suffice it to say, you know, I ended up in the application process. I pulled together this like a list of people who were willing to go to bat for me as a like scientific advisory board. And they really did advise me. And they said, I should really consider writing in my application that I will step down from my role with my advocacy group to fully focus on being a PI, because that's like a job and a half. And so I did. And I wrote that in the application, and a little bit of my soul died when I did that. I was like, oh my God, like actually physically typing those words that I was going to step down gave me great pause and made me reevaluate. What am I doing? What am I doing it for? What are my actual goals here? I mean, it's like getting a K99 at that point in a young scientist's career is like the holy grail for academic medicine. And if I was in a normal life, it would not have even occurred to me that it's actually misaligned with true impact. But looking through the lens of what is it that I actually want to do with this short amount of time, it did not feel good. And so I ended up submitting the application. And again, I got it. But like when it came through and my program officer reached out, it was so hollow to me that I started looking for jobs. And I was like, I would rather at this point take any 9-to-5 job that was 9-to-5 in true, like honesty, so that I can do all of this advocacy on the side. Because let's face it, you know, as it does not matter how smart I am, it does not matter how resourced I am, I will always only be API studying a different disease, hoping to sneak in something. And that is not actually going to save anybody's life. And it was a very hard realization, but it was very raw and it was very real. And I believed it.
So you think you asked yourself this question because of the circumstances, right? So
100%. Yeah.
So there is no other way. Like why it's not embedded in us with all the, you know, like academic training, PhD. This is what we do. We learn to ask questions. Why people aren't asking questions, those very basic hypotheses about what I want to do, what is it for, what is the end goal here, and just going with the flow and like going for a postdoc submitting K99. So yeah,
it's a really good question. And I think a lot of it is just culturally, we are groomed as scientists to have these end goals in sight. You know, our career is a career. It is a job, you know, and we, no matter how mission driven we are, you know, there are steps that are fundamentally laid out to us that we imprint on by watching everybody else who is successful in that space. None of them are there because the sole thing they need to do. I won't say that actually. That's not fair at all. I don't know what the motivations are for the vast majority of really anybody other than myself. But what I saw were people that were highly intelligent, so curious, driven by a desire to push our knowledge of human health and disease forward, but not because they thought that they would die if not, you know? And so it really does shift. And I knew I was never doing, nothing I ever did was to save my own life. Like I have no illusion whatsoever. But what I did know is that I doubt with the rarity of this disease, any other scientist will get it like and actually try to champion it. And so I did think it was like, I did feel like this burden that if I did not do this, nobody would do this because why would anybody want to do this? You know, you can't take huge amounts of resources and point them to something that only gets 300 people a year. It's not fair. You know, I wouldn't even want to do that. But so who is that person who's going to think creatively in order to really peel it back and figure out a path toward impact for this incredibly rare situation? And so I think like that's just not embedded in the way that I think scientists necessarily when they are curious and they do ask, and why am I doing this with my life? That is not really ever going to come top of mind because like, why would it, you know? So unless you're absolutely forced into a corner. So when I made that really hard decision, I started looking for jobs. And for me, like I've said a couple times, my brain just naturally gravitates towards protein biochemistry. And I went into, you know, kind of organismal level cancer biology out of need and out of necessity. But I thought I could just still do, if I could do biochemistry, like structural biochemistry in some capacity to help cancer patients, that would be great. And then I could focus on the advocacy. So I started looking for jobs. And I was like, I started looking by institution. And the first place I turned was the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard, because it's the Broad. And I thought, hey, why not do some of the best science in the world with like the smartest humans while I try to champion this cancer in the background of my life. And so I literally went onto their job site and I'm going through alphabetically their jobs because I'm looking for anything biochemistry related. So I'm like skimming through the A's as I try to get to the B's. And as I'm skimming through the A's, I see this job title. I'm like, that's interesting. Look at that. And it was for the Associate Director of Scientific Outreach and Operations. I'm like, outreach? I'm good at that. I can talk to the people. And I like opened the job description And it was as though somebody kind of like peeked into my world and drafted something exactly for me. Like, and I had no idea that something like this even could possibly exist. And it probably wouldn't outside of a magical place like the Broad, but they wanted somebody who understood the perspective of cancer patients. And they wanted somebody who understood the cancer advocacy landscape, but they also wanted this person to be like a cancer research scientist. And it's like, that is me. Wait a minute. That's so me. And they wanted this person to come in and help them conceive of and launch new platforms for collecting data that would democratize the way that we go about collecting information from cancer patients. And I was like, oh my goodness. Like if I could do that, like democratization includes rare over here. And I was like, so excited by this opportunity. So I was really lucky to get that job and to come in with open arms to the Broad. I really can't explain what a magical place the Broad is. It has incredible, just brilliance from every single corner that you walk into. And the people are magnificent and they think massively. Like one of the first conversations I had was, we're almost done with our pilot of 1,000 cell lines. And now it's time to scale up. And I was like, what are you even talking about? What? And so they just think huge. And that was what they were really trying to solve, a fundamental issue that we have in translational medicine, where the people who get studied are the folks that happen to walk into the brick and mortar, large academic medical centers. But the vast majority of cancer patients are treated in a community setting. So like 85% of people, my tumor was taken out at UMass Medical School. Do you know how much angiosarcoma research is going on at UMass? You know, nothing. For people who are listening in, that's a goose egg I'm drawing with my fingers here. And so it was like, yeah, of course. Like we do, we owe it to the people to give them the opportunity to champion their diseases, to leave legacies, leave data instead of just leaving. And that was such a huge moment of excitement and exhilaration for me when I realized what we could do. And the thought was this, that we don't know how to do it. We don't even know, should this be an app? Should it be a website? How do we do it? Do patients want to be involved? If so, how much do they, you know, they're, all of these things remain a big black box. And so I was like a kid in a candy store. I got to go in and really have this startup mentality, but inside of the Broad, in order to build this thing that ended up starting off as the Metastatic Breast Cancer Project. And to do this, you know, I worked very closely with Nick Wagley, who was my boss, and he's a genomicist at the Broad and also a metastatic breast cancer doctor at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And we just worked side by side, figuring it out. You know, like I did not know, I had no appreciation for the fact that a website has both a front end and a back end. Right. Who knows that when you're like working with fish? And so I learned that really quickly and then had to go find the people.
And you know, the fish has a front end and a back end.
It does have a front end and a back end.
And you study the development really and the hoax genes. Yeah. But the website doesn't have hoax genes.
Actually, I wouldn't say that. So, so there was like, it was so much fun for me. Like, and I don't think I could have appreciated at the time that what I was doing was basically being in a startup environment where everything has to happen. Not one person is the expert and everybody has to like figure it out together. So like, you know, figure out the website and patient engagement and genomics.
It's
and
funny, file this formats. Was your 9-to-5 job.
Yes, exactly. This was my 9-to-5. It ended exactly at 5 a.m. So, but it was exhilarating and working so closely with the metastatic breast cancer patients was absolutely like, it was just a game changer for me. Like I was in this little like cancer silo with my rare cancer people that I had in this like one little support group. I had no idea what was going on and like that there even was this like big world of advocacy, and metastatic breast cancer patients were really leading the charge in so many ways. And, you know, between us and everybody listening, I was super nervous starting here because I had a little bit of a depression around the fact that I had technically had a cancer in my breast that was likely going to kill me, but it was not breast cancer. And so I never fit in to like the whole breast cancer world. And it turns out that that's not, you know, I was not alone in that sentiment. And the metastatic breast cancer patients really took me under their wing. They mentored me. They made me feel so included in the process of advocacy and discovery. And it just, I'm still so super close with so many of them to this day. I love them dearly. Those that have passed and those still alive.
Wow. It's incredible. It's incredible how you are so focused and passionate about something completely different.
Yeah.
And how this changed your, you know, your direction of passion completely. And I remember you were telling us about some of the sort of project you actually led at the Broad Institute and in the angiosarcoma how's it called? Nonprofit? Is it nonprofit?
Yep. Yep.
Can you tell a little bit more? I remember there were really, you know, impactful things there.
Yeah. So the nonprofit is kind of like, we'll put that over to the side for a little bit and just talk about the angiosarcoma research that I was able to do at the Broad Institute. Mm. When we started the Metastatic Breast Cancer Project, we really wanted, it was a kind of an experiment in and of itself. Like, will it work? Who knows? You know, if we build this and what even is it? Let me just take a step back and talk about what the platform even is. It's We ended up building a website in lockstep with metastatic breast cancer patients so that every single thing that was all of the messaging and the imagery and the consent form and everything was built alongside patients. And so it resonates. We did that so that it would resonate and reflect the will of the patients within that community. So it's a website where people can go, and anybody listening, you can check it out at mbcproject.org. So you can go to mbcproject.org and click on Count Me In, and it takes you to a consent form that enables our study staff to collect copies of the full medical records from where patients say they were treated. We mm-hmm. send out a saliva collection kit for germline DNA. We, mm-hmm. if they can opt in or opt out, to allow us to send them a blood collection kit that they can take for a courtesy draw or take to a Quest Diagnostics. Mm-hmm. And they can opt in or opt out to allow us to get archival FFPE tissue. If people opt into everything, that mm-hmm. would enable us to perform a bunch of analyses on their tissues to include whole exome sequencing of their tumor in normal matched tissue and mm-hmm. also bulk RNA-seq. And whole exome sequencing of their blood as well, should they have a high enough tumor fraction from cell-free DNA. Wow. And then, you know, the full abstraction of their medical records, so we understand like the clinical manifestation of their disease. So what ended up happening was many thousands of people joined that project. So we launched in 2015, and as of today, over almost 7,000 men and women with the disease, with metastatic breast cancer, have joined that study, making it the largest prospective and retrospective collection of, or like, you know, cohort of metastatic breast cancer patients ever assembled. And because of the success of that project, the leadership at the Broad really wanted to test whether we could point the same platform to another cancer. Mm-hmm. And they looked at me and they said, you know, what do you think? And I said, how about angiosarcoma? And they were like, absolutely. And they let me run with it. And it was just such a pivotal moment in my life and in the life of so many people that I know and love to be able to do this. So such a rare cancer, only gets 300 people a year. It means we're all geographically dispersed. So you could never really do large scale deep study like this, mm-hmm. if not for a platform just like this. Yeah. And so we use the Metastatic Breast Cancer Project as a scaffold for the angiosarcoma project. And mm-hmm. with patients from my own community, we modified it based on what they wanted to see. And it's largely similar, but there are some key differences. And we went ahead and launched that in 2017. And we have over 600 people with angiosarcoma who have joined to date. And for a cancer that only gets 300 people a year, it's really, really,
it's amazing.
Yeah, it's really remarkable.
And you already published some analysis of this, right?
Yes. Yeah, so it's one of those situations where when something is completely understudied, you can make rapid discoveries. Mm-hmm. And so all you scientists listening out there, keep that in mind. If you want a good high, you know, if you want to like up your H index, if you want like high impact papers, go study something rare, you know, any rare disease will do. You'll make discoveries. I promise you can get it into some like a really good journal.
I'll talk to Corey if you want to study angiosarcoma.
Exactly. Yeah. Or any rare cancer. I'm like, I've like, you'll hear in a second. I really want to help all the rares out there. And so we got, I think like the first 14 samples in from the sequencers, and we host our data in the public domain. We host it on cBio portal out of Memorial Sloan Kettering. And it auto populates all of these really cool graphs. And one of the graphs that it auto populates is tumor mutational burden. And you could see, it was so striking that I showed my children who were, I don't even know how old they were at the time, but like preteen, I said, look at this graph. And they're like, Mom, there's like two things. I'm like, exactly. It's like a bimodal distribution. And sure enough, there was like this like really interesting cohort of patients that had this really high tumor mutation burden. And when you looked at who the cohort was, they were all people who had angiosarcoma in sun exposed areas, which led us to do an analysis on the UV, whether or not there was a UV signature in those tumors. And sure enough, there was. And so it was kind of a really nice hypothesis that these were sun induced angiosarcomas that led to high tumor mutational burden. And they almost looked like melanoma, but inside of endothelial cells of the skin. Okay. So, yeah. And so then because we have the full medical records and a lot of these patients were treated in a community setting, we went ahead and pulled everybody from the whole cohort who had been treated with a checkpoint inhibitor. And sure enough, three of them were people who had internal angiosarcoma with low tumor mutational burden. None of them had a response to those checkpoint inhibitors. Though I want to caveat this, really important, we didn't stain for PD-L1. I've known people who have had angiosarcoma internal who have had extraordinary responses to checkpoint inhibitors. So this is not an N of three does not tell the full story. So I just want to make sure that that's the
thing. I know, hope all scientists here sort of, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah. Leave us notes.
You need an N of four. You need an N of four before. No, I'm just kidding. So, but there's.
Wait, but Corey, it's amazing. Like finding this, and then you have a correlation. And the nice thing is that if you already outreach and there and the patient, no matter where he is or she is, already agreed to send you a sample.
Yeah.
And as the same emotions that you have expressed on being a patient of a rare cancer, you have sun exposed induced angiosarcoma. Can you, so you went along and so through this initiative, you also went along and studied their family, their relative, which are basically living in the same area. They say get relatively, I guess, the same sun exposure. It's very interesting. Then you can open up a lot of.
Yeah, that is interesting that we don't have that capacity just quite yet, but we are, you know, a nimble platform. So maybe we could add that in our, at least in our rare cancers. But going back to the sun exposed angiosarcoma, so we found the three people internal low TMB, no response, but then we found three people with cutaneous angiosarcoma on checkpoints. One of them had one dose and had an immediate adverse reaction and had to be taken off. And so they were kind of like put to the side in our analysis. Two of these people had metastatic angiosarcoma and were on pembrolizumab, and they went into a complete and durable remission. And for over a year. And then both of them around the same time had these autoimmune flare-ups, which made them have to go off of the pembrolizumab. And they remained without evidence of disease several years after they were taken off and on no treatment whatsoever. And every time we do a check to follow up on them, they are still NED as of today, which is just remarkable. And so this was the data I started, you know, in advance of publishing. I just, you know, the sarcoma community of clinicians is relatively small and very tight knit. And so they were kind enough to invite me to give talks at some of the key places where they would all be. And I talked about this data a couple of times. And then they invited me to the Alliance for Clinical Trials to talk about it. And I did to the sarcoma subgroup. And they just made a trial up right there on the fly with everybody, all the key experts were in the room. And so they designed a trial right there using like data as a backdrop to the story. And that trial is over-enrolled right now, which is so cool. Wow. And then, but there was, that wasn't the only one. There were several other investigators who one person used the data in order to get another cohort added to a basket trial. And so Andrea Sarcoma was added to a checkpoint basket trial, and those data were generated and published showing that there was efficacy for these cutaneous angiosarcoma patients the same year we published these findings in Nature Medicine in 2020. And so right now it's rolling, you know, and standard of care is changing, at least for the cutaneous angiosarcomas. And now there's like all of these kind of combination trials that are coming online, and it's really interesting. And it is, it's changing clinical care for people with my disease, which is definitely very cool.
It's crazy.
It's crazy, really. It's,
I hope everyone appreciates the circle you've come across around.
I think it's, I want to underscore like reading William Coley's notes from the late 1800s. That's the big circle, because it's going back to him, you know, and making those discoveries in sarcoma patients. It's like, it's very cool to like have started off there and come all the way around.
I have shivers.
it's amazing. And I wonder, So aside from cancer, there are other syndromes like cardiovascular, for example. Cardiovascular disease is also it's a vast name like cancer that encompasses a lot of genetic elements, a lot of issues that are very different. We manifest at the end as a heart attack or as hypertension, and I wonder if the model you have pioneered in the Broad Institute. If you think it's transferable to other syndromes, if you're looking for a champion like yourself for other mm-hmm. syndromes as well, who comes from places like that.
Totally, 100%. And we built the engineers at the Broad Institute actually built the software stack that the Count Me In initiative is you know built on, is an open source API so that other people could take and build direct to patient initiatives off of the work that is supporting and fueling Count Me In. And so there are other registries that leverage this model. And I have actually talked to some folks in the space of cardiovascular disease to help them think through and be just a sounding board to get an initiative like this mm-hmm. off the ground. Anytime you have patients that are interlinked on the internet, and you have a group of dedicated scientists, you could absolutely put an initiative like this together to crowdsource information, samples, and patients so that you can really bring our ability to study disease into the current moment.
Yeah, it's incredible. Just for scientists listening that might be interested, how easy is it to get that set of data that you collect?
It's not easy at all, which is why you know we wanted to make that software open source. It's expensive, it's not easy, but I mean it's doable. You know, it's just
I don't mean the organization. I mean the actual researcher. Data that you collect as a researcher. Mm-hmm. If you want to access, you know, the data for the metastatic cancer.
We make that as easy as possible. So anybody can go. We have one. I guess I should also say we have worked toward expanding Count Me In platform. So we had gone from metastatic breast cancer to angiosarcoma to metastatic prostate cancer to stomach and esophageal cancer to brain cancer, osteosarcoma. Oh. And then we opened the platform to everybody in the United States and Canada with any cancer at any age. So we can enroll pediatrics. So I think we have people on our platform from like less than a year to 99 years old, which is super cool. Mm-hmm. And when we opened the platform to all comers, we went from having like representation of 6 cancers to over 100, and several of them are like exceedingly rare. And again, to like that part that drives me, having created a platform that can be leveraged by rare cancer communities and doctors to make discoveries, that is like the pinnacle of achievement that I could hope for in my tenure with Count Me In. I'm so incredibly proud and happy that we've kind of laid the foundation and generated this the world of possibilities here, but we have proof of concept that works. And so we have intentionally made the data as easy to access as possible. So anybody can go to our mother site is now at joincountmein.org. You can navigate to all the individual projects there. And on each project website, there's a little flag that just says data. Mm-hmm. And it gives you all the data you could ever want. So it's like link out to cBio portal with the data browser, and you can just download all of that clinically annotated data. It has links to the genomic data commons that has all the raw BAM files. If you're, you know, an informatician and you actually know what to do because you're a wizard, it has like a patient data browser. And so we have that for the three more mature projects where we've been able to generate and release data. And as more data comes online, it will live and be deposited in those spaces. And then you can find it easily from the mother page there.
Incredible.
When I give talks, I'm always like, this is the only talk. It's okay to look at your phone. Get your phone out.
and a very important lesson for whoever posts jobs online, don't make it easy to go from A to B. Just make the candidates scroll all through the list, because they will find... Then you get your champion. Yeah, exactly.
I
just wonder what would happen if you would hear one of those moments that you said, I'm not a perfect fit for this job, I might go and look something else. Like, where were we? Like, people.
I know. And it's important for everybody, but to all the ladies out there, I just want to say, I hear these statistics about, you know, women applying for jobs when they feel like they can hit 80% of like every single mark in the job description. And that men will do the same if they can hit like 20% of all of the marks in the job description. And so I just wonder, like, I wonder if there was if women just like put themselves out there, in a way to take some risk that, maybe there would be more opportunities for all of us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I have to wonder what would have happened if you did take your professorship. Like, I think you would have definitely made some really interesting discoveries, but I really doubt you could impact so many cancers in such a way that really enables others to do so much research with this data.
I sometimes wonder too. And yeah, I think I probably would have really enjoyed it. You know, I love science, you know, and I'm a scientist in my heart, you know, so I think I would have really enjoyed it, but I think my sights would have been set at like finding data to support the most impactful paper. And that's just a different mindset than science to impact the most amount of people.
So you gave us a teaser that you adopted some tedious habits.
I did.
And I guess this is part of your day-to-day coping with everything. Like, everyone has stress. You have like stress and some. I'm waiting. I've been waiting for a long time to hear it, because I'm looking for a new habit.
Okay. All right. So, okay. A couple things. I love poetry. And I love poetry because it's so beautiful, but I also can commit it to memory. And so I like to read poetry and commit it to memory so that I can filter through it in my mind while I'm doing these other tasks that like keep me embedded in the moment. And so I will, my two biggest things that I like to do, one is garden, but not just like a garden in the backyard. Like, I pull together like a sustenance garden that I can feed my family from like June until November and not have to buy produce at the store. Wow. And so it's like a massive garden. I make all of my own sauces from that garden, and I start to germinate seeds in February and bring the whole life cycle through. And so for me, literally being grounded in the dirt and working with the earth in order to produce food that my family eats is an all-encompassing hobby, I guess, for lack of a better word. But to make it really fully functional, I also have goats and chickens for fertilizer and eggs. And then I also keep bees for, you know, being able to pollinate everything and produce honey. And so it's like a little homestead that keeps me very occupied. And I find that a lot of like my innovative thought process happens when I'm fully immersed in the moment, thinking of like a poem while like digging around in the dirt and recognizing that there are these parallels. you know, like life will rhyme, you know, like scientific insights sometimes happen because they look and feel the same as the structure of a root system in this dirt, you know what I mean? And so it just helps me really process and parallel process things that I think are important at a societal level, at a scientific level, but looking through these analogies that just come to light through the earth.
Wow. Did you also invent a time machine to do all of that?
No. But the other thing that's actually time consuming.
Oh, there's another thing.
There is another thing. And it is going on these very like long meandering walks through the woods, starting actually now in May and ending at the first frost looking for wild gourmet mushrooms. And it's one of those things, again, these are the activities that pull me so deep into the moment. I don't have time for anxiety about my own mortality because I'm so hyper-focused on something that requires me to like look for this very specific thing through this morass of like other stimuli. And so it just fully forms like this way to meditate almost in three-dimensional space while moving.
So you do all of those solo?
My younger daughter will often accompany me. So I'll sometimes get the company of my now 14-year-old.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know when do you have time for everything? It's funny.
Well, I don't watch a lot of TV.
I don't either. It doesn't help. We had, I don't know when this episode is going to be released, but we just released an episode with Professor Renitza Charo, and she's the same. She's like, she has, you know, her lab and an institute and a few companies, and she sits on the boards of other companies. And I wonder,
And she danced.
I can't dance. I'm so impressed by people who know how to do that without making a fool of themselves.
She ballet danced through postdoc.
Amazing.
Whoa, and she did a medical degree when she opened her lab. Wow. So I wonder, what is it about scientists that do 10 things and excel at everything?
I think being an actual ballet dancer through your postdoc is quite different than like raising a tomato. So kudos to her.
Depends on the tomato.
That's true. Yeah.
Wow. It's incredible. It is incredible. I wonder, so you think those activities take away the stress, or do they just put in something else? Like how do you think it works?
They act as these punctuations in anxiety more than anything else. I don't know that it like makes the stress or the anxiety go away, but those are like deeply felt moments where I'm fully present in the present moment. And so, and that's all life really is. And so the more I can try to tether into like what is right now, the less, even if stress happens before or after, I think of those as kind of like fleeting and momentary, because as much as I can pull myself into right now, this is the only thing that actually matters.
Yeah.
All right. I'd love to hear from you if you're willing to share. Not with your disease, but with your professional self, when a story of something that you really hope will work and it miserably failed, and how you cope with that. What was after? That's because you come with so much energy and a great state of mind to challenges. What happens when, how you deal with this, and how we can learn from you how to deal with our like failures?
Yeah, I mean, I think every scientist, I think one of the things we all are really good at, hopefully by the time we're like postdoc level, is coping with failure. I think, you know what I mean? I think just
definitely
science is failure. Science is more failure than success. And so I think trying to think of, you know, in my current role, like it's not scientific failure that is similar to what you might experience as a graduate student or a postdoc when your theory does not pan out. You know what I mean? Like it's a very different space that I'm in right now, because literally I'm just generating data. And so it may be that we can't reach a group of people that we really think we would, you know, would be like mission critical to our understanding of cancer. It's a very different kind of failure, but it's failure nonetheless. And I think for me, I'm as emotional as I can be in this world. I can also redirect failures and moments of real, like very challenging moments to be very calm and to approach things very logically. And so it's just when presented with a challenge, it's not ever it doesn't set me in depression. It sets me into motion. And it just is, instead of going straight, I think I now have to turn like left. And I think I probably have to go very, very far away from what my objective is. And I know to get there, I have to go this way. And it's going to look really weird to people on the outside. And I'm going to meander for a long time. But I promise that is the objective over there. This happens to be the path to get there. And so I just, I think very creatively, and I think outside of the box in order to come up with solutions that oftentimes don't make sense to the people around me, but they will get us where we need to go. The thing that triggers that is often called failure. But that, I don't, you know what I mean? Like it's just never failure if you can find a workaround.
Just a branching point in the path.
Correct. Exactly. It's just a different path that you have to take.
Yeah. I'm happy.
I actually think, yes. Yeah, no, I think it's a really important point because, you know, in my life, anything can be handled with the right perspective. And so the number one thing that I think I have that I can contribute to other people is a sense of resiliency. And that is what resilience is. It's the ability to look at something that is an extraordinary challenge, like dying from something that nobody could ever study, and not letting that stop you, but finding ways that you can make a contribution and not worrying about what it means or looks like to anybody else, you know, but taking that step anyway. And I would oftentimes describe it as trying to get, I don't know if you're familiar with the Wizard of Oz, they're trying to get to Oz, they follow the yellow brick road. And when you are facing something like this, like terrible terminal illness with like no resources whatsoever, there's not even a yellow brick road to follow. And so I took it that I needed to like find something that I could try to mold as one brick and find something that I could paint it yellow and then set it down and just have a direction. And so that was like, sometimes you don't have the direction and sometimes you don't have the resources, but it should never stop you from trying because you never know what could happen if you just put everything that you are into something that you believe in very deeply.
It's incredible.
I think we have it.
Okay. Yeah.
That's the answer to life, universe, and everything. That's like you finished Douglas Adams, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. That's it.
Yeah, but I want
in 42.
Can you tap into that? Without having something so grave to deal with, like how do you find that focus and sense of purpose without having to deal with all of that? Because obviously great things come if you do.
It's such a good question. I don't have the answer for you there because I haven't ever done it in any other way. You know what I mean? And it's funny. I was there's a man in this world. His name is David Feigenbaum, and he is such a fellow traveler in this space. And he and I will often end up in rotating in similar circles of people. He had an awful experience with something called Castleman's disease, which almost killed him several times. And he ended up championing it, starting a foundation. Chasing His Cure is a book that he wrote. I would highly recommend it to everybody. But he totally just owned the disease and like figured it out. And he's a doctor. And I think he's a doctor and also now getting into all kinds of different layers of regulatory oversight and leadership. And so he's just like a phenomenal human. And he and I have sat on panels together talking about this need to realign the incentive structures of our country and our world to like actually focus on curing humans, because we are two distinctly different humans facing distinctly different diseases that are so rare and so deadly. And we didn't figure it all out, but we certainly charted paths that rhymed with each other and got to like a significant source of impact for these two disparate diseases. So I think there are models that we could like kind of like peel the onion back. I don't know how to implement the alignment of incentives to get us there, like en masse. I don't really have a sense for that.
I think that on that. So if we neutralize for a second, which is very hard, like social media and us comparing ourselves to the best of everyone else presenting, if we look in and we're looking for this incentive, our life has, on a scale of 1 to 0, everyone has their one, their most grave circumstances that will make them champion something. You just need to find it and tap into it and not deal with that and do like professional on the other side. If find the intersect between them.
Another thing that just popped into my head is that, you know, thinking about like the similarities of like me and David, I think when people, because trust me when I say every single one of us has something tragic, like you said, every single one of us has something tragic, either directly or somebody we love. Like humans do not live forever. Therefore, the vast majority of us are going to experience like awful tragedy along the course of our lifetime. The difference, I think, is that when you have something exceedingly rare, there is zero infrastructure. So you can't already like plug in and apply that mission and that passion to an existing architecture. And you literally just have, you're forced to think very, very creatively. Whereas when you are hit by the like tragedies that are more common, you can donate to an organization or you can, you know, do something to push incrementally something that already exists that's doing a very good job in this world, but the incentive to really jump in and own it is not quite there, because it's easy to look around and recognize things that you can do that seem impactful in the moment. So that could be another thing to bring into the conversation.
Yeah. I wonder if there's a way to teach it, to sort of set some boundaries maybe to yourself of sort of how much you rely on others and how much you rely on yourself to find.
Yeah, it's a good point. There could be like an impact class. What are you actually doing? Like all of the money, if you make a donation to wonderful foundation, and I have a foundation, so I'm like speaking like follow the money, like where does it go? And then what are the results of that donation? Did it save somebody's life? Did it change? Did it give somebody, a ride to, you know, their doctor, which could be equally as important as any kind of scientific discovery to like make something new. And I would be remiss if I didn't take the opportunity to just highlight some of the conversations that I've been like really privileged to be part of in the terms of like disparities and the fact there's just such unequal treatment of people today, and lives could be saved today with what we already have, if there was solutions just implemented to bring everybody along to where we already are, let alone where we could go and the things that we need to do to cure health and disease. So,
yeah, we had a recent episode with Joe Brew, and he talks a lot about sort of, you know, there are many big questions that science has solved, but there are sort of, you know, as you say, infrastructure problems that have to be solved as well. And he was suggesting scientists solve that. And I wonder if, you know, someone else should. but
I think that's one of those things where it's up to every single one of us. Yeah. And it shouldn't be like somebody else or me. It should be literally all of us thinking deeply about like, what could we do in the capacity that we have to make sure it never gets like othered.
You can definitely count me in.
Wow. I think we need to wrap up, but this, I don't know. I hope others find it as inspirational as I do.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. And good luck in everything you do. Everything you touch sounds, is important.
Thank you so much, Corey.
I really appreciate you having me here today to talk about all this. It means a lot. Thank you.